Thomas Lux is author of, I can't even tell you how many books of poems, at least 13, but probably more. He is the Bourne Professor of Poetry and Director of the McEver Visiting Writers Program at the Georgia Institute of Technology. His awards include the Kingsley Tufts Poetry Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, 3 NEA Fellowships, the Robert Creeley Award, and many, many, many more. He lives in Atlanta, from where we're talking to him today. Thomas Lux, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Glad to be there. Heard a lot about this program. Glad to be with you.
Well, I've certainly heard a lot about you. And so when I got an advanced copy of your latest book, The Left of Time, I was very excited. And one of the things I did to prepare for this interview is to look at all your books. And I have I have the list of them here. I tried to count. I don't want to say that I'm bad at math, but at a certain point, I said, okay, forget it. I'm not going to count. That's just a lot of books. With so many books and with so much out there, what compels you to continue writing?
That's a good question, but probably because I don't know what else to do. I think I still have the fire in my belly. But you know what? Somebody recently referred to me as prolific, and I don't think of myself as prolific. First of all, three of those books are selected poems, so they've already been published. And the way I count my books is that I have published 11 with this book, 11 and a half books, and that's over 46 or 7 years. So a book every 4 years, 10 or 12 poems a year. That doesn't strike me as, I know prolific writers. So, I'm a steady writer. I'm a work a day. I know how to work. I know how to go to work. I've been very steady, but I never thought of myself as prolific. I think, after almost 50 years, books start adding up.
Right, yeah. That's an interesting perspective. I hadn't thought about that, but really, yeah, you should be writing more, Thomas. I read in the Poetry Foundation, they have a really wonderful biography about you. They say that you're vocal about the tendency in contemporary poetry to confuse difficulty with originality. And I love that statement, but can you explain it?
You know, there is a certain kind of poetry that has often been referred to as difficult. That means poets that need a critic to interpret them for the poor, dumb reader who is not quite smart enough to understand poetry anymore. And I think there's a lot of that kind of poetry. There's room for that kind of poetry. There's room for all kinds of poetry in America. But I think that kind of poetry is often put people off from poetry, made people feel stupid. I don't understand this. I don't get this. And I think that put a lot of people off from poetry for two or three generations in America. And it's beginning to change. It's been changing for years.
Right.
But like I say, there's room for all kinds of poetry. I used to get more worked up about stuff like this, but I really don't so much anymore. People are going to do what they want to do, and I just don't quarrel with it so much anymore.
Right.
It's just too much energy quarreling with other aesthetics. I'm just not going to. I just don't do it anymore.
Right, but that is I think an incredibly valid point when it comes to the accessibility of poetry. I think it turns a lot of people off when they encounter it in classrooms and they have to dissect it as if it were a mathematical equation in order to understand it.
Yeah.
But lately, in the last maybe 10 years, there's been a proliferation of publication companies, little independent publishers. Even here in El Paso, Texas, we have 3 or 4 new publication companies that are coming out with books of poems. And then you have social media, and you have just so many people graduating from MFA programs.
Yeah.
And you're getting a lot of books of poems now, and it seems that the majority of them are really accessible, and maybe sometimes a little too accessible.
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, I think the trend is it's starting to diminish on the so-called difficult poetry. I don't think that difficult poetry is necessarily difficult. I think it's most often arbitrary and kind of deliberately obscure. Or you're just simply, the poem is simply a very smart person's free associations, kind of just kind of their mind drifting around. They put it down, and that's a poem. That doesn't bite me enough, that kind of poetry.
Yeah,
it doesn't put its teeth in me enough. But there are millions of new publishing houses publishing poetry, and many of them are very good. And printing technology is so advanced now that a small press, an independent press, just starting out, can make a book that looks as good as anybody's book. So,
right,
more power to them. It'll all settle. It'll all come out in the wash.
Right, right. And also, I think that now with the proliferation of these publishing companies, there's so many MFA graduates every year that that a lot of the poetry, it's not like when you started. When you started, it was really probably very difficult to get a publication, to get a book. And poets still complain about it, but really it's easier than it's ever been.
It is, I think, to get a book published with all the new technology, really.
One of the things I love about your poetry is, it's incredibly complex, but it's also incredibly accessible. I mean, I could read it and understand it. I don't have to go, what the heck's he trying to say?
That's the point, to make it accessible enough. When I say that, I always put it in quotes, enough, so it's not like that a poem necessarily can be easily paraphrased, but it's got to be clear enough, and it's got to do something, not
right.
just reach the reader cerebrally, but also do something in their, in your gut or your
right.
bone marrow or something like that, at least first, and then you could look more carefully if you want to.
I'm talking to Thomas Lux, whose umpteenth book just came out, To the Left of Time. You are quoted as having once said, I like to make the reader laugh and then steal that laugh right out of that throat,
mm-hmm.
because I think life is like that, tragedy alongside humor. And as I dip into this new book of yours, I see that happening a lot. There's a lot of humor, but
sure.
then suddenly it's subverted. And you have one poem, and the line in that poem, I now find myself cheerful, and that makes me nervous. This is from the Nervo Sanguine poem in the third part. Do you think that statement, I now find myself cheerful, and that makes me nervous, is maybe an accurate way of describing the speaker of these poems in this book?
I think so. I think that's I never claim that the speaker of my poems is me. That,
right.
Of course it is partially. It comes out. Anybody who would deny that completely, it would be lying. But that particular statement is meant to be playful and admitting something about how I feel at this point in my life. I'm 69 years old. I don't get worked up over. Well, I only get worked up over the things that I think are really worth it nowadays. And the combination of humor and seriousness that I use in poems, or I seem to use, does confuse people sometimes. There are people who believe there's no room whatsoever for humor in poetry, and to me that seems absurd because without humor we would die. Humor is a survival mechanism. But most of the humor in my poems is satirical. It's satirizing something that's very serious. It's trying to be funny about something that's serious or dark. It's kind of mixed up. I hope, easy jokes, or I certainly don't use bathroom humor or sex humor or anything like that. It's almost always satirical. Satire.
As we mentioned, you have many books, starting with your first book was The Land Sighted in 1970.
That was a little chapbook, yeah.
Is that the half that you're referring to?
No, I don't even count that one. I don't even count the chapbooks at all, because they always get reprinted in the bigger books. So, no, I didn't count that at all. There's a couple of selected poems that have new poems in them that weren't published before. So they add up to a half of a book in my count.
Right. The Glassblower's Breath, then, would you consider that your first?
Yes, that's my very first full-length book was called Memory's Hand Grenade. And then The Glassblower's Breath was my second full-length book.
And if someone were to ask you, in fact, I will ask you, how your poetry has changed over the span of all these books. And of course, I could Google it and, hear what others have said about, you're moving from a surrealistic influence to what you're writing today. But I'd rather you explain.
Well, that would be primarily it. I was, like lots of young poets in my generation, we were enamored of surrealism, which ultimately began being called neo-surrealism, and we were enamored of it. I think surrealism is a young poet's game, and maybe particularly a male, young male poet's game. But I still, it ultimately is a dead end, surrealism. It's it relies too much on the arbitrary and chance. But I still love the irreverence and the wildness and the craziness, the imaginative leaps of surrealism. I still love that kind of stuff. But I certainly wouldn't call myself a surrealist. I used to jokingly refer to myself as a recovering surrealist. But I wouldn't. And I never thought of myself as a surrealist, but I was just, I was enamored of that kind of poetry. And there were other poets a little bit older than me, James Tate, Bill Knott, who were poets I loved and who influenced me and who came from that direction.
It seems that when young people, young intellectuals, you know, get into poetry, they are writing really from what functions best in young people, and that is their brain. Their brain is fast and quick. Yeah. But after you accumulate experience over the years, you know, you don't lose that because obviously you're, you know, you're using your brain all the time in your profession as a teacher and as a and as a writer. The intellectual kind of gets subordinate to the experience that you've had over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I like to think my poems are still fairly wild or unpredictable, but they're not arbitrary, or by the time I'm finished with them, they're not arbitrary. Surrealism is also a word, the word surreal is so abused nowadays. Everybody uses it all of the time just to mean something's weird.
Yes, exactly.
And that's not what surrealism is.
They call Kafka a surrealist.
that's not what it is. Yeah. But it had a manifesto. I mean, it was a complex literary and artistic movement, probably the most important of the 20th century, the most important ism in the arts in the 20th century, but it's ultimately, I believe, a dead end.
As I read your new book, To the Left of Time, I'm struck by some images that are so full of metaphorical possibility without you even having to direct the reader. Like, for example, the first poem, which is really very funny and poignant, is called Cow Chases Boy. And it's, you know, about this boy who's like throwing dirt clods at a cow, and the cow just suddenly rages at him and scares the hell out of the boy. It's very, very funny, but also very poignant. And what's interesting about that image, and this is throughout the book, is that your images just seem to have metaphor built into them. And it seems that you maybe have acquired over the years, and probably maybe you, even as a young poet, what Flannery O'Connor calls the onagological vision, that you see something and it strikes you and the metaphor strikes you at the same time, that you must be fun to take a walk with.
I don't know. Maybe I do sometimes see things that other people don't see. But metaphor is, I've always thought of, as my bread and butter, or most poets' bread and butter. I've always been deeply interested in metaphor, looking for the metaphor. Whenever I start something, a poem, it starts with something that strikes me, either something I see or pops into my head or something I've read, and I'm trying to explore the metaphor. I'm trying to discover the metaphor. Every poem I start is a process of discovery. I never know exactly what I need to write about the subject. I have some kind of starting point. In that case, I really did do that as a child one time. I did throw dirt. I grew up on a dairy farm, and I threw dirt balls at a cow, and she chased me up a tree. Most everything else in there is made up. I actually had to tell the publisher to put on the back of the book, they were calling it some, and then I had some autobiographical poems, and I asked them to change it to semi-autobiographical, because some of the stuff in there that seems autobiographical didn't happen at all. Like, I didn't start my grammar school on fire, for example. But I did shoot that sparrow or wren with a 16-gauge shotgun. I did do that. But most of the stuff is invented and is in searching for a metaphor. But what's the metaphor here? What's the metaphorical way of saying this? Metaphor is a way of thinking. I think I do think kind of metaphorically and in images.
in your second section of this book, you have these odes, which I think are some of the most unique odes I've ever read. I mean, I'm very familiar with like Neruda's odes and these odes to a watermelon, or ode to salt, or ode to
sucks.
Something.
I love that sucks.
Yeah.
Ode to suck tomatoes is great.
But you have odes to like, here's one that's really interesting, ode while awaiting execution. Yeah, I suppose that's not autobiographical that you've never, but I love the metaphor. I mean, you know, and again, the metaphor is so natural. It's not forced, but that whole metaphor that really all of us are waiting execution in a sense.
Sure. That's all it is. We're all waiting for execution. And that guy in that poem is, he just saying he didn't sing loud enough. That's all. He didn't praise enough.
It's interesting that you pointed that line out because I have it underlined and I was going to ask you about it. He's awaiting execution and says, I did not sing loud enough about this life, this world. Is that a fear of yours, maybe? You need to sing loud about this world?
Loud is also metaphorical somewhat. I mean, just I think my argument there is that maybe sometimes poets look inward too much and too often, and we should also be looking outward, and we should be looking at the world, and we should be thinking about the world and all the beautiful things that happen in the world, but also the injustices and the inequalities,
right,
the cruelties and things like that. So that's pretty much what I'm thinking in that poem. And again, it tries to get funny, playful, particularly towards the end, because if you tried to make a poem like that dead serious all the way through, that could seem ponderous or even pompous. One of the kind of techniques is you can go out on a limb of seriousness or rage or something, but if you can maybe pull it back a little bit with satire or with humor, so it just doesn't go over the edge and fall apart just into chaos. But that's not something I can do terribly consciously. It has to happen very gradually over the process of writing the poem. And there's nothing in that book that I wrote in less than 15 drafts and over many different days, weeks, months usually. And 20, 30 drafts is not unusual. It's just I'm a dogged kind of worker.
I had Donald Hall on the show a couple of months back. He just came out with his what he calls his last book of poetry.
Yeah.
And I asked him what book that he's ever written, which one does he value the most?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of want to ask you that question. Which is your best book?
Well, this new one. And every writer will tell you that. Every writer will tell you that. But I don't really think of it as books. I think there's maybe a half a dozen poems I have. When I look at them, I said, you're almost doing what you want to do there. Maybe even in a few moments, you're in this poem, you're hitting really nice notes. But I do think genuinely that this is my best book. But who knows? We're not the best judges of our own work.
Well, perhaps the next one will be the best one.
Yeah, maybe.
So I asked Donald Hall, you know, he talks so much about the revision process.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, how does he know when a poem is finished? And his answer, I thought, was wonderful. His answer was, I don't. I just hope that it is. And I kind of want to ask you that same question. With so many revisions, 15 times, I mean, how do you know when it's time to let go of the poem?
Well, I think his answer is great, because I don't know either. But I think it's a matter of you just feel there's nothing else you can do, at least right then, nothing else. You go through a draft and you find a few line breaks or punctuation or something like that, pacing. You just don't know. The standard answer to that used to be, of course, poems never get finished. They get abandoned. I forget who said that, Valerie or somebody like that, but the French poet. I like to think I finish my poems, but I do. I make small changes anyway, often after they've been published in books, but not major poems. But I think Don's answer is about as how does anybody know when a poem is finished?
Right. Juan Felipe Herrera, who's our current U.S. Mm-hmm. Poet Laureate, one time I did a reading with him. It was about 3-4 years ago. I read from a book of poems that I'm working on. I'm a fiction writer, but I've been working on this book of poems for maybe 4 or 5 years. And I saw him about a couple of months ago at this, you know, ceremony they were honoring him. And he goes, how's your book of poems? And I go, oh, it's, you know, I'm still working on it. He goes, don't work too hard on it. Send it out.
Well, you know, I think there's a point when you have to do that. And I know a lot of people with first books of poems, they get very frustrated. It doesn't get taken right away. They keep fooling with the book and think it has something to do with the order. I say when you feel the book is finished, it's finished, start another one, even if the first one hasn't been accepted yet. Start another book when you feel it's done. And if you're sending it around, then usually we think it's pretty finished. Yeah. And it's tough to crack, particularly the contests and things like that. But start a new book.
That's great advice from a great poet. And the latest book is called To the Left of Time. And you have it broken up in three sections, the semi-autobiographical and the odes, and then the last, I wouldn't even know how to describe the last section.
I wouldn't either, no.
But the poems are fantastic. But I want to talk a little bit about one of the odes, which to me is like crazy. It's a crazy poem, but it makes sense. Ode to Lichen. And for our listeners, lichen is what? It's like moss that grows on a...
It's not quite mossy stuff, gray, green, the poem describes it, but it's all over trees and stones, and it's a primitive form of flora, the most primitive, I think, and it grows virtually anywhere in the world, north to south, and sometimes it provides a little food. It doesn't. The poem says everything. It's just it takes everything. It doesn't take anything from its hosts, trees. It lives on the air. It gets food from the air and water from the air, and doesn't harm the trees or anything that it's on.
You know, one of your poems says, "I was good at nouns," and really, I thought that's a wonderful line in terms of just, you know, how many of us or many poets fall into poetry is the nouns, the thing itself, as Rilke would call it, and just the lichen as a noun. I mean, how did that come about?
It's in the epigraph. I always love that line from Hart Crane's, to lichen faithful, i.e. clinging. It clings to lichen faithful. So, in fact, that poem started because I loved that word combination from Hart Crane and kept thinking, what does it mean, lichen faithful? And I just tried to explore that in that poem.
Well, not to sound too corny as we wrap up this interview, but I certainly hope that the readers are like lichen to to this book, because it's a fantastic book, and I'm sure I'm going to re-enter it over and over again. Would you be willing to read one of the poems from the book?
Sure. Anyone in particular, or one of the odes? Or,
oh, I love the cow poem.
The poem is called Cow Chases Boys. It's plural in the title, in the poem that gets changed. Cow Chases Boys. What we were thinking was bombing the cows with dirt balls from the top of the sandbank, at the bottom of which ran a cave-cold brook, springborn. We knew the cows would pass below to drink, and we'd pried our clumps of dirt from a crumbling ledge. Here, August lasted a million years. There was no we. I can tell you that now. I did this alone. At one cow I knew as old and cloudy-eyed, I threw the dirt balls as if it were a sport at which I was skilled. Boom, a puff of dust off her hip. Boom, boom, drilled her ribs and neck. And one more too close to where she made her milk. She swung around and chased me up an apple tree. Her rage surprised me and her alacrity. She looked up. I looked down at her. As such with many things, I did this alone. We both knew we'd soon be called home. You know, you call the cows home at a certain time. The kids get called home for supper at a certain time.
That's a fantastic poem. I need to ask you this. As you were reading it, were you moving your arm in rhythm to the poem?
Probably a little bit. I do that when I read publicly all the time, and I'm actually surprised if I see a tape that how much I am doing that, kind of beating the time out with my hand. Sometimes I even try to hold my hand, grab the podium, so I won't do that so much, but it's just unconscious.
Thomas Lux, thank you so much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
Wish you the best of luck with this book. It's amazing.
Thanks a lot. It was a blast. Glad to talk to you.